Hello, listener, and welcome to the latest episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which me, Stephen Fielding, who is a professor of political history at the University of Nottingham, which is more of a mouthful than I thought it was when I started that sentence, and Emma Burnell, multitasking playwright. How do you want to be described? What ways can we describe you, Emma?
I'm a political journalist, political consultant, and playwright. All the P's.
Yes, and your play is in production, is it not?
It currently? Is in production. We will start rehearsal at the very end of July, start of August, and it's being performed on the 12th, 13th, and 14th of August. There will be a link in the show notes.
Yes, in 2021, listener, just in case you're listening in some distant future time. Well, that's us introduced, but what do we do on the Zeitgeist Tapes? We talk about politics and how it's kind of reflected and discussed and presented in popular culture, specifically films, TV, dramas, comedies, the occasional novel, and the odd play. So that's what we're doing. And today, listener, we're going to talk about a film that you may or may not have heard of called The Parallax View, which was first released in 1974 and stars Warren Beatty with wonderful hair, wonderful 1970s bouffant hair, and is directed by Alan J. Palooka, one of the great directors of that time, of the 1970s, who also...
isn't it, rather than Palooka? Palooka is someone who's a bit of a dope.
Well, I don't think he's with us anymore, so I don't know if he really would care, but you may be right. You might be right. You probably are right. I don't know. You're the one with the American connections much more than me. But Alan J. Guy directed three... in succession, conspiracy films, Clute, which the listener may be familiar with, The Parallax View, and then All the President's Men, which, and all of them in different ways, kind of explored the subject and the theme of conspiracy. Dramatized, completely made up in the case of Clute, actually based on the Richard Nixon Watergate conspiracy in the case of All the President's Men, and The Parallax View, which is kind of somewhere in between, which is a sort of a fictionalized version of the Kennedy assassination, or a Kennedy-like assassination, given that there were two in the 1960s, and also Martin Luther King. I think that's about all of those that were actually assassinated in the 60s. But as it says, as the central character, played by Warren Beatty, says at one point in the film, looking back on that time, said there was a time when it just seemed like, and I paraphrase, like all the good guys were just being knocked off, right? And so the film is looking into, at least in a sort of fictionalized way, what's going on, right? Because at the start of the film, we see a senator who's presumably thinking about or actually running for to be president. And it's on Independence Day and he's assassinated. And then that's the start of the mystery, which, you know, 3 years later, some of the witnesses to that assassination are starting to die in mysterious, well, in circumstances which can be explained, but given it's the number of them, it just becomes a bit weird. And that echoes the situation with the 1963 Kennedy assassination, where certain witnesses, that's part of the mythology, isn't it? That various witnesses die in circumstances, so they can't then point to the man in the wooded knoll and whatever. So the central character, Joe Frady, starts on a journey, you know, to look into this thing. I mean, initially he's skeptical, but then he starts to think there might be something to it. So the Parallax View, I mean, because I've watched it quite a few times. It's one of my, I'd say it's one of my more favourite films. And also I've watched quite a lot of conspiracy films from this time. And obviously conspiracies are now the almost default setting in many political dramas. So rather than me, you know, continue blabbering on. I mean, Emma, this was the first time. I don't think you'd heard of it, had you?
Heard of it. It's a famous film, isn't it? But I hadn't seen it before.
So what did you think?
I didn't really know what it was about. I mean, I have to admit, from the title and the fact that it was from the 70s, I thought it was a sci-fi film. I thought it was very good. It mixed genres slightly oddly at times. So there were moments where I felt like I was watching an episode of The Dukes of Hazzard.
The car chase. Yeah, there's a
car chase, yeah. And the bar fight were a bit.
Yes. Yeah.
Didn't really sit with the whole paranoid style 1970s thriller. But the rest of it did do the paranoid style 1970s thriller very well. I thought the sequence on the airplane where he's trying to work out how to stop the plane without it being him who gets in trouble was very well done and quite clever. But it also, at that point, was when I worked out what was going to happen at the end.
Did you realise the ending? Because I'm not sure we should really mention the ending, but the ending's really...
You always do spoilers, Steve, so...
All right, okay. But the first time I saw it, the ending really shocked me. I literally was going, you can't do that. How did you know the ending was going to be as it was from the plane?
They made a big deal about him trying to not be the guy that gets set up as the killer. And they also made it clear that the Parallax Corporation was an ongoing project which would be killing more people. Right. And I thought, really, there's only one way that goes. He either becomes a killer or he gets framed as a killer.
Right. Well, yes, how we negotiate that the spoiler thing there, I don't really know. But yes, because it starts off, like I say, with the senator being assassinated, and then there's a kind of a commission, which is a Warren Commission, saying there was no conspiracy, it was a lone gunman. And it ends with another Warren-type commission saying exactly the same, lone gunman, because another person is assassinated, another politician is assassinated. And as it turns out, don't listen to this bit if you want to enjoy the end, listener. And it turns out, as you say, they'd set up Joe Frady to be that killer, the lone gunman, even though obviously he wasn't. It was part of a conspiracy. So it's a very bleak ending. I mean, it's got some funny bits in it, and like you were saying, the car chase is a bit weird, and the bar scene when he goes going to what's it called, Salmon Tail, in search of. Why did one of the witnesses drown? It's a bit odd, but then it settles down when he pretends to be the lone gunman type, which are the people that they're recruiting, because that's what this corporation. I mean, the corporation, we're never sure what's the purpose of this corporation.
Yes, there's very. I mean, that for me, I think. I'd love to see a sequel that actually explored what the Parallax Corporation was all about and who they were, because at the moment it's just, as I say, it's just that kind of 1970s this corporation is bad,
yes,
connect kind of thing. There isn't necessarily an ideology
that we're aware of.
It seems to be very much just like, you know, corporatism. We will kill you for money.
For no apparent reason. I guess that's maybe this kind of the spooky bit. I mean, the spooky bit partly is because it ends with the corporation, you know, it's got away with it again. Another lone gunman has assassinated another politician. They can move on to the next job. They're in the clear. The hero is dead. The hero is shot. He's dead, listener. Warren Beatty dies. Jeez, that's got to be a bit of a shocker. But we never know what the motives are, because they try to kill a politician in the plane with a bomb. But then he's also, it's pointed out during the course of that little scene that there's his opponent, who presumably is trying to get the nomination for whatever party, because we don't know the parties of these politicians being knocked off. that his opponent is on the opposite side of an argument, which we don't know what the argument is. And then it turns out that his opponent, it's a failed attempt to murder this other politician, that his opponent on the other side of the argument, he is the victim that Joe Frady, you know, doesn't kill, but is set up to be the murderer of. So it's a kind of, in the period of the early middle 1970s, when, you know, Nixon was doing it, people were still talking about the Kennedy assassinations. And then this film comes along and says, you know, it's worse than you think, you know, because there is no clear motive that we can find out. It's just a faceless corporation that's doing it.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting with the both sides of that senatorial contest being victims or potential victims is that clearly there isn't an ideology. This corporation isn't doing it for an ideology. It's doing it for whoever pays them to do it. I mean, it kind of gets excessive, I suppose, once you're at the second murder and the third attempted murder of this of a senator, senatorial candidate, you start to think, well, hang on a little bit. you might start noticing. There was a show which I watched for a bit. I didn't watch all of it, but called Scandal. Have you ever heard of Scandal?
Oh, Scandal's great. We should do Scandal one day, but it's just crazy.
Yeah, I stopped watching Scandal when I was watching a presidential debate with three people on the stage who'd actually killed people with their bare hands. And I was like, yeah, nah.
Yeah, and they'd probably all shag the same president as well, probably being Scandal.
Everyone was shagging everyone.
Yes. Yeah, Scandal is definitely a subject for the future, maybe. I take your point that when the number of politicians they must have been systematically knocking off. But then again, you know, the 1960s, John F. Kennedy knocked off, Martin Luther King knocked off, Robert Kennedy knocked off. And around about this time, George Wallace, although nobody ever seems to be bothered about George Wallace, was shot at and crippled but not killed. Gerald Ford, of course, the one assassination attempt of Gerald Ford, they couldn't be bothered to hit him. They missed. But there was a lot of stuff going on, and every single one of them was allegedly a separate motive. So there was a lot of stuff going on, you know, in the 10 years or so before the film was made.
I mean, interestingly, every single one of these could have been and probably was a separate motive. It was a singular actor, but the actor wasn't the one with the motive because they were basically just it's anti-outsourcing, if anything.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny that they could have left the card saying, courtesy of the Parallax Corporation, if you want any business, yeah. Weddings, funerals, particularly funerals, bar mitzvahs.
How did we do?
Yes, pray to us. On assassin advisor or something. there is a kind of, I mean, if you think about it, there is a kind of potentially amusing aspect to this. But it was, I mean, it did emerge out of a very dark moment in American social and political history, when all these sort of figures who represented certain, and usually, you know, relatively progressive, in some cases very progressive ideas, were being knocked off by lone gunmen for no underlying coherent reason. And the Americans were
JFK next.
Oh, I love JFK. Maybe after we've had a few more non-conspiracy films, but. JFK was obviously motivated by Oliver Stone's fervent belief that there was this conspiracy, not a corporation, but top level. One of the interesting things, I mean, the film is a conspiracy film, and it's got other tropes that you would associate with a conspiracy film. It's got some variations which are really good. The character of Joe Frady, played by Warren Beatty, sort of a down-at-heel, deadbeat investigative journalist on some obscure Oregon local newspaper. I mean, could local newspapers afford investigative journalists in those days? Maybe they could. But the person that was...
Actually, the local press in America was really quite strong and powerful then. Mm. A singular paper in Oregon might actually have had the same sort of budget as the Times.
Sad days, Reed. Sad days. Nowadays, so he's a kind of anti-establishment figure, as you can tell from his hair and how he lives. Kind of a bit sleazy, really. It's maybe slightly obsessive about things, but he's not very nice to women, is he? He's got a bit of an attitude.
He has a throwaway woman whose name we never learn,
and she never speaks. Yes,
and she never speaks. And then there's the ex-girlfriend who he patronizes literally to death.
Yes, yeah.
Did you note that she is a returner to the Zeitgeist tapes?
Paula Prentice.
Yeah.
Yes, she was. Now you're reminding me, because she was in.
She was the best friend.
Stepford Wives, wasn't she?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yes. And actually, now if we're doing this kind of trivia stuff, the ex-FBI agent that Joe Frady gets to give him an alternative identity is the actor whose name I've forgotten, but he plays the Nazi playwright in The Producers.
Yay!
Moving on. So he's a down-the-hill journalist. And they actually have a discussion. He has a discussion with his editor, who's kind of a sympathetic character, but he gets frustrated with Joe's apparent obsession, bizarre obsession with this conspiracy, although eventually he kind of believes him, he's persuaded, that you can't, because the editor naively is going to contact the police and the FBI, and Joe says, don't do that, because I'm not saying they're in on it, they may be in on it, but they don't know that they're in on it, because one of the, when he goes up and has that odd car chase and the fight over ordering some milk, in the bar, the local sheriff is part of the conspiracy. So this the tentacles of this conspiracy go all the way, down to local sheriffs in the backwaters of Oregon. So it's an extensive and vast conspiracy. But you can't the only person you can trust is this down at heel sort of slightly somewhat sexist, with unaccountably beautiful hair, Warren Beatty, who...
It did occur to me when they start to try to recruit Warren Beatty, because he sets up a psychological profile by asking a psychologist what would a psychopath say.
Yeah.
One of the points of hiring these assassin people are that they blend in to the background. Now, Warren Beatty... is never, ever going to blend into the background.
Yes, he was probably voted the most beautiful man in 1974. I mean, I don't know whether he really was, but certainly his hair would have been. That's true.
He's a pretty attractive guy, yes. But it did make for it to be slightly less realistic.
Yeah, but that's one of those things you have to take on board, that they all look much more attractive than real people. But... No, that's certainly true. But I think what we should do is we're not going to do a clip for this episode, because one of the things about this film is there isn't much talk, and it's very visual. And I have to say, when it starts to settle down, it is very impressive, the cinematography and all these kind of blank surfaces with lighting, and it's very, it's like. You can't penetrate surfaces in some ways, and the music is also very good.
It's said explicitly that the reason we couldn't really find a clip is there's not a moment where someone kind of goes, and here's a bunch of exposition.
Yes, there's no eureka moment, is there? Because that's the whole point. There is no eureka moment, because the Parallax Corporation is completely obscure in its motivations. But what there is something which I think Emma's going to put it on the.
Show notes.
On the show notes is there's a scene which lasts for maybe about 5 minutes. I mean, it seems to go on quite a bit, where as part of the process of assessing Joe, well, he's not called Joe Frady by that moment, he's assuming another identity, just assessing whether he's bonkers enough to be employed on a mission to be set up as the lone gunman, to make it credible for him to be seen as a lone gunman, is this the parallax, I think it's known as the parallax test, where he just sort of sits in a darkened room with his hands on some monitor, some sort of sensors, to, so they can gauge his reactions to a series of images, and there's music to the images. And I think that is, I mean, I don't know if it won awards or anything, but it's one of the best sort of scenes, although it is just a series of images, that I've seen in cinema, certainly of that time.
It's very cleverly done, because they, I mean, it starts off with a fairly straightforward mom, country,
youth. Apple pie. There's literally an apple pie in there, I think.
Yeah, an apple pie, man. But yeah. Then it mixes up those images with more negative connotations, and kind of builds to a heightened, I guess, paranoia. You know, and it's interesting because you're watching. While theoretically you're watching him watch it, actually you're just watching it.
Yeah.
But because you have that knowledge, I guess, that also that he had. So it's a very, very clever way of doing it, because he didn't get particularly turned by it, but that was because he knew that he was going in there not to be. Mm. We know that we're not going in there to be. So we're looking at it with that critical view as well. But you can see how clever a piece of propaganda it would be, you know, in particular circumstances for particular kinds of people.
Mm. No, I think it's remarkable. And yeah, if you don't want to watch the whole film, listener, definitely look up the link. And it's just the way, like you were saying, it starts off with, you know, love, mother, father, me, home, country, God, and all of that, and that's all in the appropriate way, and then it all just jumbles it all up and then inverts it, so that, you know, mother and father, they end up being terrible people, you know, in terms of the jumbling up, and you get Hitler in there, you get Mao in there, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's very good. It's really, really good. So I think they kind of did, I mean, it wasn't the director who did it, they kind of farmed it out to a specialist group to do that, but yeah. Definitely a very good plus. So that's in instead of a clip, because we watch or read something and we're looking for, well, what clip can we use to illustrate it? And I realised actually they hardly say anything. You know, the text in this is just so limited, and that's clearly deliberate, isn't it? The playwright.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my play, there are two scenes where no one speaks. And they're absolutely essential to the plot. And a lot of it will be on, you know, just body language and the actors. But that 98% of human communication is nonverbal. So I think in film in particular, it's really important that we see that kind of happening and taking place and being really strong, because otherwise, you know, why? When you read a book, even a lot of it is very visual. You know, there's a lot of visual description. Sometimes it's too much. So
Thomas Hardy. Yeah.
Me, I was thinking Dan Brown. Dan Brown has written books that he knows are going to be made into films.
Oh, right. So, right.
So it's like, it's, yeah, and he picks up the phone and you're just like, well, you know, there are better ways of doing that.
Right.
But it's really important that, you know, we are projecting our own imaginations onto this film, but we're also guided by a lot more than just the words.
Mm. I mean, in a way, I guess the filmmakers, because they're not, I mean, BT was on the left, you know, sort of Hollywood left at that time. I mean, a lot of people on the Hollywood left made these kinds of conspiracy films. And with the implication, I mean, the implication is, I mean, it's only one that, well, it's a corporation, so it must be defending, you know, representing somebody's interests, some, you know, various rich guys or other people with money, because they're the only ones that can afford to not, you know, pay these people to knock these people off. That these were, that the conspiracies that had been conducted against, and the murders, you know, of the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King, had been funded in some way by people within the establishment of some sort, or corporations themselves. And but they cleverly don't do that. They don't say that, because then that leaves to the viewer. They can make, you know, they can make up the motives themselves. So in a way, it was astute, because then you could be right wing and left wing, or somewhere in the middle, and project onto the corporation what you think it was. But also, you could just, like, I mean, it might have been the deliberate thing just to leave it like that, because that is, that's more frightening. That's more spooky than if you could say, because of course that's the point about why some people say there's a lot of people like to believe in conspiracies, because it's like the idiot's way of explaining complexity. And you could say, yes, I now know it was, you know, them. They did all of this. If you don't know, if at the heart of this conspiracy, there is no heart,
that's much darker, isn't it?
It's much darker. And the film apparently didn't do very well at the time. And it might have been for all of those reasons. I mean, if you kill off your hero at the end of the film and you say, well, you know what, there you go, this is just going to keep going on, it's a bit bleak. You know, if you're in the early 1970s and you're looking at that and you go, blimey, I wanted a nice ending. I wanted some hope. And who just killed Warren Beatty? What have you done? You know.
I only came to watch this because I like Shampoo.
But his hair's not quite as good as in Shampoo, but it's still very, very good.
His hair. I think that may be the fifth time you've mentioned his hair.
Well, like, it is quite spectacular, and maybe if the listener does watch it, they may agree. They can email in. They can send a message in about, agree about his hair. I think it's one of the best conspiracy films, and of course there are so many conspiracy films now, but it's one of the best, one of the first, and I think one of the first to say, you know what, the good guys don't win. You know, it's quite complicated what's going on. There's no solution, no easy solution. So it might sound a bit of a downer, but it's a really good film.
It is a very good film, and it's pacey and interesting. And it does take a little while to work out what it is, I guess. And some of it is a bit kind of odd, jarringly, like, different style. Partly, I think, my guess is that was because Warren Beatty was very, very famous in the early 70s. And if he's going to take up a film where he's going to die at the end, he's also going to get to win a bar fight.
But I think most Hollywood films of that time, I mean, they all had to have a car chase. I mean, the car chase, I think, was de rigueur, so they had to get that in. And it's actually a good car. As car chases go,
it's not a bad car chase. Just like, why am I suddenly watching an episode of The Dukes of Hazzard?
Yeah. No, it doesn't fit in with the general tone. You're absolutely right. It's a bit jarring, but nonetheless, it's not a bad car chase. But I think it's just one of those things. Audiences in the 70s, if they came out of a film and there wasn't a car chase, you know, Jane Austen or whatever it was, just, I feel cheated. Where's that car chase?
I mean, one thing, it doesn't really have an ideology, but it did point slightly in favour of the status quo, the system, right at the very beginning. And it kind of dropped this thread. But one of the things that I really noticed when during the first assassination, which is the opening kind of scene, is the amount of times the senator or the senatorial candidate guy, who may or may not be running for president, I think, is described as independent.
Yes. Yeah.
To the point where you don't really know which party he's from. And, you know, I thought that was quite interesting, because that maybe kind of, again, you didn't know which party he was from at all.
Mm.
But also if it could have been either side going, you know what, we don't want someone who kind of messes up our two-party system.
Or to characterise someone then and now, I guess, in American politics or even in our politics as independent, that sort of brings sort of positive values. You're not chained to the party. You're challenging things. You know, you might be a centrist, very probably you are if you're described like that. Most of these politicians are being knocked off. They're all conventional politicians, aren't they?
This would be described as independent because technically he's never taken the Democratic whip.
Right.
And on the other end of the spectrum, Pat Buchanan would have been.
Yes. Yeah, I guess so. But I think maybe in that context, it was in the way that I suggested. But it's a Hollywood film, so therefore it's got some parameters to it. It's not going to, I mean, although, you know, Warren Beatty would go on to make the film Reds, which we have also discussed, and he has wonderful hair in that film too. That's a bunch of American Marxists. You know, there are certain parameters. He's not going to preach revolution in this film. It's meant to be an entertainment, but it must have been a bit of a spooky kind of an entertainment in 1974, which may explain its failure to do so well in the box office. Like I say, it doesn't have the happy ending that All the President's Men has. When Nixon is discovered, it's all been proven, and there he's flying off from the White House. It's not that wonderful moment, but it's got more people now think it's a better film than it was in its day, and there's a lot to be seen in it. It's a treat.
I really enjoyed it, so thank you for because we've been talking about it. You've mentioned it on this podcast many times before, so I'm glad we finally got round to talking about it.
It works. It kind of works. You know, kind of just persistent, sort of drip, drip, drip. Well, anyway, yes. That's it, listener. Watch it. Tell us what you think about it, if you wish. So this is the end of yet another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, and it behooves me to say that this is a political human production, and to thank Lord Stuart Wood for the theme tune, and to urge you, to plead with you, to beg you to rate the podcast on whichever platform you happen to be listening to it on.